Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. So I want to speak about the dynamics of neutron star mergers, and I want to discuss three aspects that we can learn from simulations and which I think are particularly relevant when we speak about the multi-messenger interpretation or observations of these events. So I want to start with discussing the immediate outcome of a neutron star merger. So just the question whether the merger remnant directly forms a black hole on a dynamical timescale or whether you form a neutron star remnant. And so we introduce a threshold binary mass for the direct formation of a black hole. I want to show you then one example why this is so important, and you will see that by a multi-messenger interpretation of 170817, we can arrive at equation of state constraints and can, for instance, establish a lower limit on neutron star radii. And then I want to speak a little bit about the mass ejection of neutron star mergers, and I will focus on the dynamical mass ejection, so the immediate outflow of a neutron star merger. And then combining these two aspects, I want to sketch some very simplistic strategy for observing electromagnetic counterparts that could tell us something about the threshold mass. Then finally, if there's time, I also want to speak about post-merger gravitational wave emission, which could tell us something about the dynamics of a merger and can also be linked to a multi-messenger interpretation. And the motivation of all this is, of course, that we want to understand better the incompletely known equation of state of nuclear matter or of high-density matter in general, and we also want to understand the formation of heavy elements through the rapid neutron capture process. So in this sketch, you see the different stages of a neutron star merger, and you know we start with a very long in-spiral phase, and then when the orbital period is about a millisecond or so, the two stars touch and they merge into a single object. And the stability of this object depends on the equation of state, which is not perfectly known, and the total binary mass. So for relatively high total binary masses, you find that the object is not stable and it directly forms a black hole with some high angular momentum matter forming a torus around the black hole. For somewhat lower total binary masses, you form such a neutron star merger remnant, where this object is stabilized against the collapse by mostly rotational effects. So even if the mass is above the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star, this object can be stable at least for a while. And then the final fate of this object again depends on the equation of state and the total binary mass, so it might undergo a delayed collapse to a black hole torus system, or it might form a stable or long-lived rigidly rotating neutron star. So now let me speak about this collapse behavior, and what I mean becomes clear when we have a look to these two simulations. So we distinguish the prompt and the delayed formation of a black hole. This is a simulation for 3.5 solar masses and this for 3.4 solar masses for the same equation of state. And you realize that this guy here, the slightly more massive one, directly collapses into a black hole, while the lighter one here is stable for at least a few milliseconds. Okay, so this is what I mean by collapse behavior, and this is very relevant because it can tell us something about the equation of state. It has an impact on the conditions for launching a relativistic outflow, and it also affects strongly the mass ejection and therefore the R process and the properties of an electromagnetic counterpart. So to put it a bit simpler, we have the in-spiral, and then either we have a prompt collapse or we don't have a prompt collapse. And the important thing is that we can distinguish these two cases, for instance, by the presence of strong post-merger gravitational wave emission from this neutron star remnant. And then we can introduce this threshold binary mass, which in this example that I showed is maybe something like 3.45 solar masses. And binaries with a mass that is beyond this threshold will directly collapse, while lighter systems will form a neutron star remnant. And of course, this threshold binary mass depends on the equation of state. We can expect, for instance, that it will somehow depend on the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star. So we want to understand in detail how this threshold mass depends on the equation of state, and this can be explored with simulation. So all the results that I'm showing are obtained with a smooth particle hydrodynamics code that uses the conformal flatness condition for solving the Einstein equations, and these are all temperature-dependent equations of state because thermal effects can play a role here. So these are all simulations that have been employed in these simulations, and you just run a lot of simulations with different binary masses and you check the outcome, and then you can determine for every equation of state the threshold mass. So the threshold mass is just given here. And for every equation of state, you can also compute the properties of non-rotating neutron stars, for instance, the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star or the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star, whatever. Okay? So once you have this data, you can start playing around. And you realize that this threshold mass that you get from simulations depends on the maximum mass, for instance, and the radius of a neutron star. You see the threshold mass increases with the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star, and it also increases with the radius of neutron stars. Okay? And it turns out that you can fit these data with empirical formulas. For instance, here, this one, which just tells you that the threshold mass can be described by the maximum mass and the radius of this maximum mass configuration of a neutron star. Or another empirical formula that works similarly well is here, just the threshold mass as function of the maximum mass and the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron star. So you describe this empirical data relatively accurately with these formulas. Okay. So now, as I said already, the point is really that the question whether you had a prompt collapse or no prompt collapse is really important because it has a very strong and decisive impact on the observables. For instance, you can use it to constrain the equation of state. It has a strong impact on the mass ejection and therefore on the properties of the kilonova and possibly also on the on a short gamma ray bursts. I should also mention that this threshold mass is relatively insensitive to the mass ratio, but it's very strongly dependent, of course, on the properties of the equation of state. And it's also something that one can relatively reliably determine in simulations. And for instance, in comparison, if you would like to consider the lifetime of this neutron star remnant, so the collapse time scale, the observables depend in a much more continuous manner on this lifetime. And it's also harder to determine in simulations because you need to model a lot of effects like the mass ejection, neutrino emission, gravitational wave emission, and so on, if you want to determine this collapse time scale. It's also harder to measure probably. And similarly, it might be also harder to obtain the exact path towards a rigidly rotating supermassive neutron star because you really need to take into account a detailed evolution of the mass and the angular momentum in the system. So this is why I would like to advertise this threshold mass as really a very characteristic and important quantity in this whole business. And with this, let me speak about the simulation results for the ejecta. I focus here mostly on the dynamical ejecta. I think Daniel will cover a lot of the secular, the post-merger ejecta. So here you see snapshots from a simulation, color-coded the density, and the dots are fluid particles that become eventually unbound. And you see here that most of the material in these symmetric mergers here originates from the contact interface. It's squeezed out between the stars and then pushed away by the oscillations and the rotation of the remnant. So this can be also seen here in this movie. The black dots become eventually unbound and the white fluid elements are formally unbound. And you see that most of this matter gets unbound when the two stars merge and they rotate around each other and then they bounce. And in this first expansion phase, most of this matter gets unbound. And then you have still some oscillations of this remnant which further unbinds matter. Okay. Here you see some systematic dependencies of this dynamical ejecta mass on the equation of state and the binary masses. So here you see color-coded the dynamical ejecta mass in solar masses as function of the total binary mass and the mass ratio. So you realize that the dynamical ejecta mass depends on the mass ratio. The more asymmetric, the more ejecta you get because you have an additional component of tidal ejection from the lighter star. You see a mild increase of the ejecta mass with the total binary mass, but you also see that if you go beyond some threshold, you have a reduction of the ejecta mass, and this is exactly when you have a direct collapse to a black hole because this first expansion phase of the remnant is missing, so you don't support this additional ejection of matter, and that's the reason why prompt collapses lead to relatively small ejecta masses. This can be also seen here, so these are results for symmetric mergers of the same total binary mass, but for different equations of state, and the different equations of state are here just characterized by the radius of a neutron star. These are stiff equations of state, these are very soft equations of state, and you see that softer equations of state produce more ejecta simply because they collide in a more violent manner, and therefore you eject more matter. But you also realize that very soft equations of state lead to a reduction, and this is again because of the prompt collapse, where you don't have this additional support from the remnant. There are two more remarks which are important. The first is don't take all these numbers here literally, because it's really difficult to resolve the ejecta. Okay, so there are certainly uncertainties of several 10%, depending on the physical model, the numerical methods, the codes that you're using. Okay. But overall, there is a relatively good agreement between the different codes, so this is encouraging. And another comment is, Daniel will address this in more detail, I assume, that this is only one part of the material that gets unbound from a merger. There is, in addition, ejecta that you expect from a post-merger remnant, from a black hole torus or from a neutron star torus. Here you see, for instance, a compilation from literature results which compares this dynamical ejecta mass that I discussed to an outflow that you obtain from the merger remnant, and you see that this is really indeed comparable in mass. And now, when we compare this to the ejecta masses that were derived from 1708-17, we see that these masses here are compatible with what was observed. It's certainly at the high end, but it's compatible more or less with the simulations. And if you're very brave, you would conclude already that tentatively you can exclude very stiff equations of state because they lead to smaller ejecta masses, and maybe you also exclude very soft equations of state because they result in a prompt collapse. Okay. Just one note on the ejecta morphology. So this shows you the density in a plane perpendicular to the equatorial plane, and you see that you have ejecta also in the polar direction. So this is a symmetric merger and this is an asymmetric merger, and in every case you also have significant mass ejection along the poles. And if you now also understand that the disk mask is produced later and with a slower outflow velocity, it means that the dynamical ejecta will always sit on top. And I think that's something to keep in mind when you interpret observations. For instance, I think that this early blue component that was observed is, in my opinion, from the dynamical ejecta, because if this material had a very high opacity, then would obscure any blue component beneath. Because here you see that really all the, also in the polar direction, you have dynamical ejecta, which would obscure everything that is beneath. So this probably means that neutrino FX weak interactions raise the electron fraction so that you get relatively transparent material in the polar direction. So now we can combine the threshold mass and these ejecta results, and we can come up with a constraint on neutron star radii. So the argument is relatively simple. So this electromagnetic counterpart was relatively bright. And so we might argue that this provides strong support that there was no direct black hole formation in this event. Because even for asymmetric mergers, the ejecta mass is relatively small. Okay? So if you accept this argument, then we might conclude that there was no direct black hole formation in this event. And that would mean that the measured total binary mass of 1708-17 is smaller than the threshold mass for direct black hole formation, because in that case we expected small ejecta masses, which was not the case. Okay? So now, if we accept these arguments, then we need to conclude that the threshold mass is larger than the measured total binary mass in this event. And if you recall this empirical relation that I introduced at the beginning, we understand now that this expression here is larger than the measured 2.74 solar masses. Now we need one more ingredient, and that's causality, which tells us that the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars is smaller than this expression, which contains the radius of the maximum mass configuration. That's a very old and robust result that you obtain just from TUV solutions. Okay? So what we can do now is that we use this inequality here, so the measured total binary mass is smaller than this expression here, and we insert the maximum mass here and here, and you see that what remains only depends on the neutron star radius, which means that the measurement here gives you directly a lower limit on neutron star radii. And this can be visualized here. So here you see this constraint if you do this calculation in more detail. And as I told you at the beginning, you have also an empirical relation for the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron star. You can do the same exercise and you get a constraint on the radius of 1.6 solar mass neutron star, which is shown here. Okay. So of course, this is not yet very restrictive because you only rule out very soft equations of state, but in the future you will get stronger constraints, and in particular if you observe a prompt collapse event, then you will get an upper bound on neutron stars, which is maybe not so exciting because you have the tidal deformability, but you will get also an upper limit on the maximum mass of a non-rotating neutron star, and this is, I think, very exciting. So I think it has a lot of potential for future multi-messenger observations, and the nice thing is that you only need low signal-to-noise ratios in gravitational waves because you only need the measured total binary mass, but you need a lot more follow-up observations where you can distinguish whether you had a prompt collapse or not. So one more comment on this empirical relation. So sooner or later we will know this radius here, and then you see if we measure this threshold mass, or if we can constrain it, get upper and lower limits, then we can use it to determine this maximum mass. So this is very interesting because then we can really get a relatively robust measurement of this maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars. So and thinking about this threshold mass, I thought about some very simplistic idea how what is the best strategy to obtain this maximum mass. As I said, it's really an important quantity because it can be used for radius constraints, it can be used for measuring this maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars, and also plays an important role for the electromagnetic counterpart and GRBs. So the problem is, of course, that maybe not for all gravitational wave triggers you want to start an extensive search, and therefore the question is, what are the most rewarding events, okay? And maybe also you want to know which events are possibly hopeless to find, or which instruments do you want to use to find them, okay? So if you accept this simple picture that a prompt collapse leads to a dim electromagnetic counterpart and no prompt collapse leads to a bright electromagnetic counterpart, then we can set up the following strategy. So this measurement, 170817, gave us a lower limit on the threshold mass. Now measuring a lower total binary mass will again be no collapse, so that's not really interesting in improving this rate. So what we want next is to test the electromagnetic counterpart of an event with a higher mass, okay? Because then either we can strengthen this limit here, or we find a prompt collapse, which means we get a measurement of the maximum, or a constraint of the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars. Okay, so what we should search next is really an event with a higher total binary mass. Of course, this binary mass should also not be too large, because if the binary mass or the GRB mass is larger than the 3.73 solar masses, you can use any equation of state that you like. You will again get a prompt collapse, and that's probably an event which is dim. That means it's harder to find, and it's also telling you not much more, because this we know already. Okay. So it also means that if you expect a prompt collapse, you should use a very sensitive search, because these events are dimmer and therefore harder to find. Then, of course, once you have an upper limit of the threshold mass, because you observe the prompt collapse, then you should just use the events in between the lower limit and the upper limit, or masses in between the lower and the upper limit, to constrain the threshold mass even more accurate. And if LIGO doesn't want to release the masses in a trigger right away, maybe it could be meaningful just to provide a flag whether you expect a prompt collapse, whether you expect no prompt collapse, or whether you think both is possible, because this could help you already in telling something whether you expect a particular bright or a particularly dim event. Okay, with this, let me just quickly speak about gravitational waves and the post-merger gravitational wave emission. So here you see the typical gravitational wave in the time domain, and here you see the corresponding spectrum, and you see that this spectrum contains a lot of substructure in the kilohertz range, which originates from the different oscillations that you excite in the post-merger remnant that you also saw in the movie before. So this gravitational wave emission was not yet detected, but it's something that becomes possible latest with third generation instruments. And the interesting thing is that this dominant oscillation frequency can tell you something about the compactness of the remnant, and therefore about the equation of state, and it can tell you something about neutron star radii, but that's another story. I want to point you here to the substructure here, which is produced by different mechanisms. So this smaller peak here, for instance, is produced here by these tidal bulges, which you produce directly after merging, when the stars are getting stretched and deformed while they are forming the merger remnant. And if you have this thing here very pronounced, then you have here very strong bulges, which also produce a lot of ejecta. If you have this guy here very pronounced, this is a coupling between the radial, quasi-radial oscillation mode of the remnant and the quadrupolar mode of the remnant. And if you have this very pronounced, it tells you that there are strong radial oscillations of the remnant. And this is also something that can tell you something about the internal dynamics of the remnant and of the mass ejection. So that's something that should be at some point embedded in a multi-messenger picture, taking the dynamics from the gravitational waves and the mass ejection of these events. There's also a systematic dependence of these different features on the equation of state and the total binary mass. So this dominant feature here is always present in all the models, because it's just the dominant oscillation frequency of the remnant. And then you find that this F-spiral feature here is particularly pronounced for low total binary masses and for stiff equations of state, because the stars are less compact, and therefore you favor this formation of these tidal bulges. On the other hand, if you have relatively high total binary masses or a soft equation of state, the merging will excite this radial mode particularly strongly, and therefore this coupling between the F mode, the quadrupolar mode, and the radial mode is particularly strong. Okay, so one can really understand these systematics here, and you can basically distinguish three different types of of post-merger spectra depending on the strength of these different features here. And with this, I'm at the end of the talk, so let me just stress once more that I think that this threshold mass for direct black hole formation is really a very important quantity because it really affects strongly the observables of a neutron star merger, in particular the electromagnetic emission of neutron star mergers. And in turn, it can tell you something about the equation of state, in particular the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars. Then I was speaking about the different ejector components, focusing on the dynamical ejector, and I showed you that it depends in a systematic way on the equation of state and the binary masses, and that the prompt collapse leads to a reduced amount of ejector. And if we use these findings, then we can argue that in 1708-17, we probably did not have a direct formation of a black hole because it was a relatively bright event, and I showed you that this sets a lower limit on neutron star radii. Now, I showed you that using the same idea, the same method, you can come up with even better constraints in the future, and in particular, you get an upper limit on neutron star radii and the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars. But for this, you need more follow-up observations, and I suggested here what could be a way to really maximize the gain of follow-up observations. Then finally, I was showing you that the gravitational wave post-merger emission can also tell you something about the internal dynamics of a neutron star merger, and that can be also linked to the different observables in a multi-messenger picture. Thank you.
Question?
That mode at around 1.5 kilohertz, which you said was a nonlinear coupling.
Yeah.
How do you know that's a nonlinear coupling rather than some high order G mode?
So essentially what you do is that you try to find in the simulations what is the frequency of the radial mode, and you know what is the frequency of the quadrupolar mode, and you expect this coupling to occur at the quadrupolar, the frequency of the quadrupolar mode minus the frequency of the radial mode, and this is precisely here. So in the simulations, you can simply check this. Also, you can analyze the eigenfunctions of these different modes. So this is, I'm pretty confident that this is this coupling here.
So do you actually compare the eigenfunction with the velocity field within the simulation?
So there are different ways to determine the frequencies. You see, for instance, the frequency of the radial mode already here in the central lapse function. You see these oscillations here. This is already the quasi-radial mode. And you can compute, for instance, or you can get an idea about the eigenfunction if you take a Fourier, you take in a plane the Fourier transform of the pressure as function of time. Then you pick the amplitude of this Fourier transform at the given frequency that you are interested in. And then considering the amplitude in this plane, you see what is the structure of the eigenfunction. And then you can become quite confident, for instance, that at this particular frequency here, you have the quasi-radial mode.
Yeah, I have two questions that are quick. The first one, on one of your first plots, there was the dynamical ejecta as a function of the total mass and the mass ratio as the color plot. How does that change with the equation of state?
Qualitatively, it looks very similar. Just, of course, you have then here this threshold for stiffer equations of state at higher masses and for softer equations of state at lower masses. But qualitatively, it looks relatively similar. Here you see how everything depends on the equation of state. I mean, the softer the equation of state, the more ejector you get. So here you get redder spots if you want. But qualitatively, it looks the same.
Okay, and quickly, I just wanted to ask, can you comment a little bit on what we can learn about the inclination of these systems from, the electromagnetic observations and maybe how that might connect back to the Hubble constant?
I think inclination is difficult to, I mean, the problem is that I think it's fair to say that these emission models which are used to interpret these observations are still need to be improved, let's say, right? So I think it will be very difficult at the moment, at least, to infer the inclination angle from that and to compare it to the simulations. I mean, the emission models are one problem, the simulations are another problem. I stressed here that really these not even the ejector mass is really converged in a mathematical sense, right? Because you really resolve small amounts of matter that you propagate on a large grid. And so I think there's still a lot of work to do to do such kind of analysis.
Okay, there was first.
So going to constraints on the equation of state, so I'm trying to understand how well things would have to be measured to actually improve our knowledge of the equation of state, because if you go back to your plot where you showed kind of pushing down from the lower radius, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have, you know, it's probably not a complete set of equation of state models, but there's quite a wide range, right? And so, you know, even if we narrow things down much more dramatically than with 17-weight 17, would you get more information from this approach versus from the post-merger signal? Or I'm trying to understand where is really the critical.
So I think the post, I mean, for improving the lower limit, this might be not so instructive. But if you get really a prompt collapse event, I think then it really becomes interesting, not so much because of this upper limit on neutron star radii, but because you exclude here the maximum mass. Or you constrain it from above. So this is just what you expect in a hypothetical case if you had a delayed collapse at 2.9 solar masses and a prompt collapse at 3.1. And then you see all these areas here are ruled out and there are not many equations of state left. So if the threshold mass, the true threshold mass is somewhere here in between, then I think you really can learn a lot. I mean, you see that there are only a few equations of state left. I think, in particular, getting the maximum mass of non-rotating neutron stars is really a big step forward. And I think a prompt collapse event would be really very, very helpful. And also these lower limits, I mean, the tidal deformability, you know, constrains the radius of neutron stars from above quite well, but not so much from below. And therefore, also improving these limits, I think, it can be quite interesting.
Hi. So in your spectrum of the post-merger signal, if I understand correctly, you are identifying that F peak at the 2.5 kilohertz with the quadrupolar mode or the F mode of the hypermassive neutron star. Couldn't also that be associated with the a bar mode, just the rotation of the deformed star? How can you tell it's the F mode?
So you can do this analysis that I tried to explain before, that you try to understand what is the eigenfunction of this mode. And another thing that you can do is that you take such a merger remnant, you wait a few milliseconds until it settles into a nearly equilibrium or quasi-equilibrium state. And then you can add a velocity perturbation such that you re-excite the F mode. And what you find then is that you get a new peak exactly here at this position. So this is, I think, very strong evidence that this thing here is really produced by the F mode.
Okay, thank you.
Apart from the fact that you actually, that you expect the F mode to be very strongly excited in such a system.
Okay.
The last two questions, Brian and then Emmanuel.
So I agree with you that that the dynamical ejecta is a promising way to get the blue kilonova, and that was what we forwarded initially as explanation. But the one thing that worries me is just that, you know, at least our current models, we do need, you know, at least a hundredth of a solar mass, if not a bit more. And your models were reaching up to that. But I think if you talk to other people in the VR community, they would say, okay, we get way too little dynamical material for, you know. So I guess, and you emphasize the fact that different groups seem to be converging, but you also emphasize that you felt everything is under-resolved.
Yep.
So I'm trying to kind of reconcile these. Is it really possible that the simulations could be off by factors of 3 or 4, maybe even order of magnitude, or whatever we need to make a few hundredths of a solar mass comfortable?
Absolutely agree, sure.
So you'd say that you think they could be, I guess I'm wondering, do you think that the simulations could be off that much?
Maybe not an order of magnitude, but certainly a factor two, I think.
Okay. So maybe able to do the dynamic. Okay.
Okay, well, last three questions.
Yeah. When you combine the mass threshold with the causality constraint, those are for non-rotating neutron stars, right?
Yeah.
So can they be applied to a post-merger from binary neutron star? Isn't rotation relevant?
So the thing is that what I did here is that I constructed an empirical formula. I have the threshold mass on the one hand, and I try to describe this threshold mass only by non-rotating stellar parameters like the maximum mass and the radius. Okay, so all the independent quantities, this was all non-rotating neutron stars, and therefore I can use this causality limit.
We can talk later. I'm just wondering whether this applies because I expect the remnant of binary neutron stars.
No, the point is that I describe them by non-rotating neutron stars, and therefore I can use this limit for non-rotating neutron stars.
Okay. Thank you. So